Almighty has his orders.
Morning. Schaefer, who I don't know, maybe you do. Barbara Llewellyn's husband hand prints nice things like this. And Jerry called Rohatsu. Alan got a copy of this as well. So it's a little poem about Rohatsu Sashin. Maybe you've seen it. Day and night, in the chilly hall, the little group sits cross-legged. I try to forget myself, press on with a task, but a week goes by without enlightenment. Knees aching and tired of making the effort. A woman asks this morning, "Why am I doing this?" I know better than to try to answer. When I open my mouth, it will be for lunch. So, today I'm going to put my foot in it. And explain why we sit zazen. Why are we doing this? I think we all understand what Dharma and Dharmas is, even though we probably don't. So I'm going to explain something about Dharma and Dharmas, and why that's that understanding is important in understanding why we sit zazen. Vasubandhu, our ancestor, Vasubandhu, originally was a so-called Hinayana scholar. And his brother Asanga was also a scholar, but his brother Asanga became a Mahayana scholar. And they were both Abhidhammists. Abhidhamma means the study of the Dharmas. So Vasubandhu also became a Mahayana scholar, but his Abhidhamma became Mahayana Abhidhamma instead of Hinayana Abhidhamma. So Abhidhamma, we always tend to think of as kind of Theravada, or Hinayana means small, Mahayana means big, large. So Vasubandhu's Abhidhamma is much wider and includes, is based on non-duality, of course. That's why Vasubandhu is one of our leading ancestors. Vasubandhu Daiosho. So Vasubandhu wrote many things, but his most famous is the 30 verses. And in the 30 verses he says, Atman and belief in Atman and Dharmas don't necessarily mean that our belief is accurate. In other words, just because we think that there are is Atman and Dharmas doesn't mean that they really are. So in other words, he's talking about the illusory quality of Atman and Dharmas. So what is Atman and what are Dharmas? Atman means self. Dharmas mean those things, those constituents which form the self. So these are two aspects of what we consider to be ourself. What am I? I am a self. And what is it that makes myself? Well, all the things I think, all the things that can constitute this form dharmas, feeling dharmas, perception dharmas, thought dharmas, and consciousness dharmas. Those are the five skandhas: form, feeling, perception, thought impulses, and consciousness. So the Heart Sutra, of course, is talking about the emptiness of skandhas and dharmas. This is what the Heart Sutra is addressing. This is Nagarjuna's philosophy or understanding. So Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu are the two complementary Mahayana philosophies. So there are the dharmas, which are empty. And then there is the dharma, which is emptiness itself. Dharmas are what we think of as forms. And dharma is what we think of as emptiness, basically. So what we're mostly concerned with in our life is the dharmas. And when we think about our dharma and dharmas in our practice, we think of dharma as, Suzuki Roshi would call dharma big mind, and dharmas small mind. Those things, those dharmas which we are so concerned with in our daily life are called, without understanding, they're called delusion. That whole realm of discriminated dharmas is called the realm of delusion. It's not bad, it's just delusion if we don't understand dharma. So dharma is all about dharmas. Dharma is the study of dharmas. Abhidhamma is the dharma of dharmas. So in the seven factors of enlightenment that we've been sort of talking about, the second one is investigation. Investigating, what that means is investigating the dharmas. Trying to understand the dharmas. And they fall into various groups. Wholesome dharmas and unwholesome dharmas. The unwholesome dharmas are grouped in greed, hate, and delusion. And then we have the subcategories of what constitutes greed, what constitutes ill will, what constitutes delusion. And then in the wholesome dharmas, we have the categories that constitute beneficial actions for ourselves and for others and so forth. So there's kind of this division into good dharmas and bad dharmas and neutral dharmas. And there's a Vasubandhu's categorization of Abhidhamma, of the list of dharmas, is he constitutes 100 dharmas, 100 constituents that are what we call altogether ourself. So Shakyamuni is, you know, the little poem about there is no self, there's only dharmas that are continually interacting in continual change. Simply dharmas rolling along. There is no self in the dharmas. In other words, there's no Atman within the dharmas. There's just dharmas. So the dharmas that are rolling along are called conditioned dharmas. They only arise through conditions. And then there's a whole list of what the conditions are, which I won't go into. But everything arises through causes and conditions. I mean, this is basic Buddhism, right? We should understand basic Buddhism, something about it. So all the dharmas that's why we say all the dharmas are empty, because they're continually rolling along and they don't last for more than that. Nothing lasts for very long. But the image lasts for a long time. It does. The image in our mind lasts for a long time. And we through our imaginative conception, we say, well, the mountain is there. And it's, every time we go there, the mountain is there. But it's a different mountain every time. But in our mind, it's the same mountain. And we climb the mountain, it's the same mountain. But actually, it's moving. But we conceptualize our world through our imagination in order to give order to our life. So the way we order the dharmas in our life is we are actually creating our life through the way we relate to the dharmas, the way our dharmas relate to our surroundings. So we say our life is self-creating. There's not somebody that's creating our life, but except us. So this is why we can change our karma. Because since everything is changing and nothing is fixed, we can always change our karma. Suzuki Roshi says, the one thing about Buddhism that is unique is that we have the ability to change our karma, to change our direction, so that instead of creating bad karma through our unwholesome actions, which are dharmas, we can turn and recreate or continue to create our life through wholesome dharmas or through neutral dharmas. So we have good and bad dharmas. But there are also dharmas which are unconditioned, not created through conditions. And one of them is called space. But it's not the space of the sky. It's simply space, which is not filled with something, which actually allows everything to change. Otherwise, everything would be solid. So this space, for lack of a better word, don't take it literally, but for lack of a better word, is what Suzuki Roshi would call big mind. He said, everything exists within our big mind. Big mind actually is expressed through small mind. In other words, our enlightenment is expressed through the dharmas, through our actions. So you can say that big mind is enlightenment. Empty space is enlightenment. And activity within delusion is the discriminating activity through a small mind is called delusion. But enlightenment and delusion are just the two sides of one thing. But they're not two sides. We call them two sides because we're talking about them as if they're two things. For purposes of explanation, we say two sides. So, mostly in our life, we're aware of discriminating activity. We're born into the world of a discriminating activity, which is necessary in order to move and relate and sustain our life. But what we're not so conscious of is big mind, which is the source of our activity. So we say enlightenment is already there, but we're not aware of it because of our discriminating activity, which is so all-pervading that it covers our big mind. So instead of saying get enlightened, it's better to say reveal enlightenment. So why do we sit in zazen? When we sit in zazen, we resume big mind. We come back to or rediscover our big mind, which is free from discriminating mind. So even though big mind and small mind are not two things, we say form is emptiness and emptiness is form, right? Big mind is small mind, small mind is big mind. But small form is form and emptiness is emptiness. So it's like two sides of the moon. When we look at the moon, we see the bright side, but the dark side also is there, hidden. So when we're in activity, one side is revealed, but the other side is hidden. And then when we sit in zazen, one side is revealed and the other side is hidden. So when we sit in zazen, we let go of the discriminating mind and just allow non-discriminating mind or whole mind to reveal itself. That's all we have to do. If we try to do something else, then we cloud our pure mind. So we sit zazen for the sake of zazen, not to gain something, because if you gain something, you cloud your mind. Anything that enters in clouds the mind. So rather than trying to get something, in zazen, we let go of everything. Which doesn't mean that there are no thoughts. When we say stop the movement of the conscious mind, doesn't mean that you stop all your thoughts. You simply pay attention to everything. Because as soon as you want to stop something, then you're bringing up a discriminating mind. So to stop the activity of the discriminating mind, we just let everything come and go. This is called equanimity. Whatever comes is reflected in the mirror of our mind. So, Zazen is the mirror mind. It's when our thought process is stilled and everything is reflected just as it is. And then our ego sees everything equally. Pain, pleasure, all the same. We don't discriminate by wanting something. So Shakyamuni says, the reason for our suffering is our discriminating mind, which wants something. So we cease the activity of the discriminating mind, which wants something. Wants, either wants something or wants to get rid of something. So to be comfortable is just to let everything come and go. And that takes continuous practice forever. At the same time, we need to discriminate. Discrimination is not bad. Discrimination is necessary, but discrimination on the basis of ego, I want, is not necessary. Ordinary discrimination is necessary. We have to be able to tell one thing from another. And when we're hungry, we eat. When we're tired, we sleep. That's proper discrimination. Improper discrimination is, I want. I need. So we have to discriminate between proper discrimination and improper discrimination. So when we say, you know, let go of discrimination, it doesn't mean to let go of what you need. It means to let go of what you don't need. And then our activity becomes compassionate and helpful and non-egotistical. So, when we investigate dharmas in Zazen, you know, the mind is always working all the time.
Is always what?
Working. Working and producing thoughts, feelings, and emotions and so forth. But, you know, when we're sitting Zazen really comfortably means letting everything come and go without attaching to anything, then we can sit comfortably. Pain is just a sensation or a feeling, but it's not necessarily suffering until we attach to it. Sometimes we have a wonderful feeling which we call, maybe this is it. Like, we grab onto it, and as soon as we hold onto it, of course, it turns into its opposite. Unfortunately, attaching to pain doesn't turn into its opposite. But if we don't attach to it, it can actually be pleasant. There's something wonderful about being right in the middle on that wire. You don't fall into the side of pleasure, you don't fall on the side of pain or displeasure, but the pain and the whatever feeling there is comfortable. There's a comfort in it, even though it's painful, there's a comfort in that pain. And as soon as we don't like it or don't want it, then it becomes uncomfortable. So our intention is very important. Our intention to simply sit and experience whatever is there. Investigation is like to experience all the dharmas that come up. Physical dharma, which is a pain dharma, or a pleasant or a pleasant feeling dharma. These are feelings dharmas, or a mental or emotional dharmas, which are anxiety or whatever, and perception dharmas, which are kind of seeing in a certain way, and understanding things in a certain way. And of course the mind dharmas are continually bubbling up, which we talked about the other day, a thought bubble, a dream bubble. Dream bubbles and thought bubbles continually appearing, and we just let them appear. Every thought bubble or feeling bubble just appears, and it's reflected in the mirror of our mind. But we don't chase it after it, even if it's a good thing. Even if it's a wonderful insight. At the same time, bad thoughts will come up. All kinds of thoughts will come up. This is called the scenery of our life. It's like we're in a train passing through and watching the scenery of our life. So this is existing in form. Emptiness is emptiness. This is emptiness is emptiness. The other side of the moon is covered in the shadow. So we don't hanker after anything or discriminate between anything. And then when we get off the cushion and go outside and do our activity, the moon is turned around. And it's just activity, just discriminating activity. But because we have this experience of emptiness is emptiness, our activity can, if we're aware, and even if we're not aware, we become more compassionate, more understanding. On our level of perception is different because our activity can be enlightened activity, because we know both sides of the moon. Did you have your hand up?
Within Zazen, so we've been looking at the factors of enlightenment. And we were looking at mindfulness and investigating the dharmas, and today you were describing the dharmas and their impermanence, but sort of as they color and flavor things, as they create the scenery.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, as they are arising in Zazen, moment by moment, do we see them, is there any kind of attention or awareness of them as dharmas? In other words, does the mind come together for a moment, or as one way that one can practice, or just allowing them without any naming or identification?
Just allowing them, because when we name something, we give it a form. Naming engenders form. So there are people who say, "Oh, this is the, you know, this anger, this is whatever." But in Zazen, but we don't do that. I think that is okay, but it helps to maybe to bring your attention to awareness of the dharmas. But I don't think we need to do that. Just let everything come and go, rather than you recognize the form. I don't think you need to name it. If you want to name it, then you just say form bubble, mind bubble. But I just want to say one thing, because this is incomplete. Emptiness and form. Dharma and dharmas. There's something that encompasses both of those, which is beyond vijnana, beyond that, which is beyond our experience. And how do we know it if it's beyond our experience? So it's our intuition knows something that's beyond our experience, which encompasses both enlightenment and delusion. Which is, you can't really talk about. There's somebody else besides Mary. Yeah.
As I understand that, the pasana kind of meditation, I'm wondering if the difference is not just a matter of words describing something. In other words, say there's a feeling of anger about something. In order to talk to somebody about, well, what do you do in that situation, you might say, well, just recognize that there's a feeling of anger going through,
mm-hmm.
rather than, you know, getting a head shoot or something. So when you say that, then you can imagine that a person first starting out might actually think those words in their mind by saying, there is a feeling of anger going by now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not necessary. It's like you said, you don't have to say, oh, there's a feeling of anger, and then here's a feeling of joy. That's just a description trying to convey to you what you do. What you actually do might be not in words. You're just noticing that there is, oh, this angry feeling or something.
That's right, because a description takes the place of the thing. And that's what we're doing all the time. We're actually, through our discriminating activity, we're actually replacing the thing with the description. And that's exactly what Suzuki Roshi talked about all the time. We replace the thing and all of the Mahayana teachers, we replace the actuality with our by removing ourselves and describing it. And as soon as we describe it, it's no longer it. So our activity is to stop describing and simply experience. Simply be it, actually. So when a thought arises, that becomes the object of it, the subject of our attention. We don't dismiss it or something like that. It's there, but we experience it as a feeling or as a thought. And then we let it go. So everything is acknowledged, not dismissed. Acknowledge, and then we say goodbye. Goodbye. There you are. Goodbye. Because my promise to myself is to sit for 40 minutes watching, taking care of my posture and breathing. That's my promise to myself. So everything else is extraneous. But we don't say, because it's extraneous, it shouldn't be there. It's not an intrusion. If you think of it as an intrusion, then that creates more of a problem. Thoughts are not an intrusion. Feelings are not an intrusion. Nothing is an intrusion because there's nobody there to be intruded upon.
What did you say? After saying nobody's there, you said?
To be intruded upon.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's no intrusions. Things are just passing through. And there's nobody to be intruded upon. There's nobody to be angry. There's nobody to be upset. There's nobody to be nervous. There's nobody to be anxious. There's nobody to be hungry.
I think before you said that Suzuki Roshi said that Buddhism is unique and that we can choose the wholesome dharmas over the...
Because we can change our karma.
Change our karma, which means choosing the wholesome dharmas over the unwholesome ones. And I thought about every religion, and except maybe Calvinism, said something similar.
Probably, yeah.
That we can
change, yes.
Make choices, choose actions and attitudes that are wholesome.
Right, but that's true. Probably they don't talk about karma.
How is karma different than, say, original sin or...
Oh, really? Very different than original sin.
It's a bad choice. then comeuppance or all sorts of other words that express a similar idea.
Well, yes, they do. It's like, Jesus says something like that. I can't remember the exact. I'm trying to remember. As you sow, though, so you reap. Yes, that's right. So, yeah. The way we think about karma is a little different. Yeah, well, although basically that's the same. Mary had her hand up.
I'm here in the dark in the corner. I know it's impossible to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But
it's not impossible to talk about.
You said there's something that encompasses it all. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay. Well, when I hear you talk like that, I get really uncomfortable because it sounds like you're talking about a lot of people, sort of liberal Christians or something, their idea of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm uncomfortable with the use of the word thing at all. And as I say, I don't know how you talk about it. So I don't know. But I just want to invite you to talk about it or is or thus or whatever. Talk about it some more, if you would.
Well, basically, big mind. So, if we stop there, then that means that because when we talk about big mind and small mind, that's according to our understanding, but we have to understand that it's bigger than that.
Could you talk about it as
I don't know,
as a process or isness or is-ing or something like that?
Yeah,
or is it?
That's right. there's it, which is not nameable, in Dharmakaya, basically. So Dharmakaya is ungraspable, undefinable, unnameable. We just say Dharmakaya because it's the Dharma realm, right? It's like, if we don't get beyond definition, then we get stuck in our defining mind. So we have to get beyond definition. There's something beyond definition. And definition is a way of talking about something that we can understand. But we have to understand that there is more than we can understand. That's true understanding. So it's Dharmakaya, okay, our true nature. So, but our true nature, you know, is more than we can understand. But we talk about it in ways that we can understand it, even though it's beyond the way we talk about it and can understand it. And we don't know what that is, but we know that that is, because it is it.
My question related to Mary's, and you answered part of it. I was thinking, beyond the words, it's the look in the eyes, it's the flower, and it's not labeled, it's just...
Yeah, right, yeah.
So, is that right?
Beyond labeling, right. That's true. So as soon as we start to define it, we lose it. So.
Yeah, I wonder if, you know, one of the things Mary's sort of getting at, certainly is something that I kind of, you know, get a little stuck on, is that we talk like that, there's a tendency to kind of reify, even if we can't explain it, there's something else there that's an it that's beyond, say, our grasp, but there's this... kind of subtle, maybe not so subtle, reification of it.
Meaning what?
It, you know, it's just like there's a thing.
Oh, I see.
We can't describe it. We can kind of give labels to this and that. Mm-hmm. But there's this other thing that.
Well, it's not another thing.
Encompasses but, all the yeah. other things.
Well, yeah, it's not another thing. There's no other.
That's what he's saying.
There's no thing.
There's no thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So. yeah.
Leaving metaphysical speculation, I would like to go back to the practical. And when I'm sitting, sometimes it will just automatically happen. Yeah, there's a nice integration between awareness of breathing and things coming and going. And then other times, just not like that at all. And it's kind of, things come and get stuck, and then I think I should be stuck on these things, try to get my attention on my breath, and it kind of skips back and forth. And I'm also not sure how hard I should try to concentrate on the breath. So those are my questions.
Right. So, it's really difficult to do shikantaza. If you think that you always have to be concentrated constantly. So it's not a concentration practice in that sense. And some people mistake it for a concentration practice. Like Yasutani Roshi, when he described shikantaza, he said, shikantaza is like such a strong concentration that you can only do it for about 20 minutes and you break out in a sweat. But Suzuki Roshi didn't describe it that way. You know, Zazen is a lot like your life. sometimes you're there and sometimes you're not. It's not, even though we talk about the two sides, both sides are there. And concentration waxes and wanes. Sometimes it's one-pointed and sometimes it's big. When it's big, when it's, your concentration is very wide and you're not trying to pinpoint it on some particular object, this is big mind. It's your big mind which is not focusing on something special, but whatever, the dust, you can just watch the dust, you know, floating back and forth. It's just, whatever is there, you just see totally, as it is, without naming it as really bad. Just to see it, as when the airplane goes by, you don't say, oh, that's an airplane. It's just a sound. just sound. So we go in and out of concentration when the mind starts wandering. And then, oh yeah, come back. Don't push anything away because that's rejection. Don't hold on to anything because that's possession. So sometimes you think, gee, this is not so good, you know, my mind's wandering and so forth. But it's just all part of that big mind. Not some special state of mind. Just what we think that because there's a special state of mind, we're not matching it. But it's not a special state of mind, it's whatever is there. So, sleepy Buddha. Unconcentrated Buddha. That's all. No judgment. As soon as you start making a judgment, then you're in the realm of delusion. No judgment. So you can't judge how zazen is. You can just do it. And whatever is there is what's there. No judgment. Ron? Or
Dean, no, whatever her name is. So when we talk about it, it becomes something different than what it is.
Yeah.
So when it sort of happens and at some point you sort of, there's a sensation or there's a realization that it has happened, does, when you have that realization and you haven't talked about it, but is it something different then? And if it is something different, how come that sense of peace or acceptance or whatever, if that continues, is it something different then?
Is different from what?
Well, you know, when we describe it, it, like, there's the red flower. When I say it's a red flower, I've put my notion of it being a red flower on it, so it's become something different. It's
what it hasn't become something different.
Right. It's become I've made it subjective.
You made it subjective.
So, in that moment when it's just a flower, and I realize, okay, well, I just did it, didn't I? I just named it a flower. In the moment, from having that, I don't know, sensation, for lack of a better word, to during that acceptance or whatever it is, when I feel that in my body and I haven't named it that, and I just have that pleasure from it, is it something different because I realize?
Well, there's the direct experience and the indirect experience. Direct experience is, indirect experience is, that is red flower. That's substituting your experience for it. Substituting is stepping back from pure vision. Pure vision just sees things. It's okay to say there's a flower, right? That's not wrong or bad.
But it becomes something.
But it replaces the direct experience with a a sign. Signpost.
Is that like the, I've been reading about this commentary on the Platform Sutra.
Mm-hmm.
That's got a lot of that in it, doesn't it? That kind of talking about that stuff?
Probably. I think so. Cool.
I guess I have a lot of things to say, but one thing is, I didn't really like that poem. Because, I guess I didn't like it because, you know, not discriminating way, of course. because it reinforces this idea that we maybe we take refuge in when we're having a miserable day during Sashin or something. That, but, you know, to me it's like a very, just to be open to, you know, Zazen can be a really wonderful experience. It can be anything.
I think that's what they're saying.
Oh, okay, then I like it. I feel like it's, you know, for myself, I'm shedding ideas I have of what Zazen is. And we're always, I feel like I, you know, when we use words, and we're a bunch of wordy people, by the way, you know, it's like a constant shedding of, oh, this is what I thought this was all about.
Yeah. I think, you know, the main thing is the hardest, you know, there's nothing wrong with our discriminating mind. That's not a bad thing. But when we're doing Zazen, we're letting go of it. In our usual activity, we, you know, like to collect things and collect information and work for some kind of result. But in Zazen, we don't work for a result. We don't try to get some result. We just be here and have a direct experience of just being present and expressing. When we're just present without discriminating mind, it just allows our, that's called resuming our true nature. And then we are expressing, like a flower, what's a flower doing? It's expressing its nature. We express our nature in various ways, of course. But in Zazen, we express our nature without anything in between, without any idea about it. We just let actually nature express itself. Because there's no one sitting Zazen.
Resume our Buddha nature?
Resume our true nature.
It's pretty dramatic when you do Sashin that you're taking a real vacation from regular life.
Yeah, called taking a rest.
And so what I hear you saying in some ways, if you can bring that same sort of consciousness to coming in and doing 40 minutes of Zazen.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But Zazen, but Sashin, you know, kind of wears away because of the constancy of it. It wears away stuff. Yeah, it's hard to consciously let go, but doing this over and over, you have all these problems and things just drop away by themselves. So that's kind of the advantage of Sashin. After the fourth day, you know, pretty soon that's all there is. It's just Zazen. Mary? You have your hand up?
I
Ms. Yeah, there's another Mary.
I did have my hand up, but not just that minute, but before I did it. I think this is a Dovin's question, probably been asked and answered, because these lawyers have why is it so strenuous? Why do we, I think you just answered it. Why do we have to sit? If the mind is all there is.
Well, body is mind.
Or why doesn't it shine through more easily?
Yeah. There's no difference. The body and mind is one thing. So, body, mind, breath, universe. One thing. One piece. That's Zazen. So there's no chopping things into pieces. That's discrimination. Discrimination is chopping everything into pieces. Or distinguishing one thing from another. In Zazen, we don't distinguish any body, from mind, from breath, from universe. That's why it's called non-discrimination. We're not distinguishing. We're allowing the one piece to be there rather than chopping it up. And when you say strenuous?
Yes.
Well, it shouldn't be a strain. When you begin to practice, you do stretch yourself to the limit, because Zazen means your whole total body and mind in your whole body mind in total dynamic activity. This is the most dynamic activity if you really do Zazen. You're totally present. That's why posture is so important. You're presenting yourself to the universe as totally. Total presentation of yourself to the universe. And so, why do this? It's total dynamic activity. Zenki, it's called. Stogen calls it Zenki. Total dynamic activity. Then, you understand what Zazen is. If it's just this, you don't get it. That's why I always emphasize posture. Sitting up straight, not leaning to the right or the left. If you lean to the right or the left, that's eccentric. So Zazen is to be centric. And this is eccentric. This is eccentric. So you try to become as centric as possible. Centered and balanced. And then, and it looks like there's no activity, but actually it's the total dynamic activity of one act, like a spinning top. When you spin the top, it looks like it's standing still, but it's in total dynamic activity. And if you hit it, it goes skirting across the floor because of all that potential energy. So if you Zazen, you should be filled with energy. If you get tired, there is tiredness, of course, which goes with it, but even within that tiredness is lucidity and awakeness, energy. So I'm going to stop there. Side, you know, as Zazen is both letting things come and letting everything come and go, and at the same time sitting upright. So, to always maintain that balance. If you're always maintaining that balance, then you don't get tired. But if you err on the, you know, if you lean on one side more than the other, then you get tired or you wonder, why am I doing this? When you are totally like that spinning top, the question, why am I doing this, doesn't come up.